Hello, I'm Sean Lay. Thanks for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Friday the 8th of November. We hear why Iran is being accused of plotting to assassinate Donald Trump, how the Church of England's most prolific known abuser, though dead, is casting his shadow over the future of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. Why did Gus, the Emperor Penguin, drift thousands of miles off course? The British Antarctic Survey tells me why he's not the only member of the species with problems. After the death of the last surviving member of the Archer's original cast, June Spencer, at the age of 105, we hear in her own words the sad story of how Peggy Woolley's fictional life imitated her own. The South Korean women forsaking men, marriage, motherhood and sex, and why some anti-Trump Americans have followed suit, and how Beyoncé has finally put her husband Jay-Z in his place. During his re-election campaign, Donald Trump was shot by one would-be assassin, stalked by a second as he played golf, and now it's emerged was the object for a third. The US Justice Department has announced charges against three men, two now in custody in New York, and a third who's still believed to be at large back home in Iran. The Ford assassination plot was allegedly directed by Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps to avenge the death of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, killed on the then US President's orders in 2020. BBC correspondent Will Grant is following the Trump transition from near the president-elect's home at Mar-a-Lago in Florida, and I asked him how much is known about this case.
Sean, you may remember that in September, the Trump campaign said it had been briefed by US intelligence, that there was apparently a threat against Mr. Trump, to assassinate him that had come from Iran. Now, we see now that the Justice Department has unsealed criminal charges, has brought criminal charges against three people apparently involved in that plot. Specifically, Farhad Shakiri, a 51-year-old Iranian man. He was charged alongside Carlisle Rivera and Jonathan Lodehole, both of whom are from New York, over, it appears, a plan to murder a US citizen of Iranian origin, someone who'd been speaking out against the government in Tehran, but were, the US government alleges, part of a wider plot against several targets, one of whom was President-elect Donald Trump.
Now, one of these three men isn't actually in the United States, as far as the Justice Department knows. Is that right? So, I mean, effectively, are they kind of charging him in his absence?
Yeah, that's right. Mr. Shakiri is still at large. The other two men, Mr. Rivera and Mr. Lodehold, appeared in the courtroom in New York. But the other man is believed to be back in Iran. The US government says he's an asset of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and is believed to essentially be back in Iran. So in terms of what the US Attorney General said, he linked it to sort of the ongoing conflict with Iran, the ongoing hostilities with Tehran, saying there are few actors in the world that pose as grave a threat to US national security as Iran.
And what happens next in terms of this prosecution?
Well, given that it's very unlikely that the US government will be able to get Mr. Shakiri back on US soil, or at least as things stand, then I think they will simply continue with the cases against the other two men, Mr. Rivera and Mr. Lodehold, and we'll see in the coming days whether or not there is more information or anybody else who they intend to charge over it. Given that the campaign at the time said that the briefing involved real and specific threats from Iran to assassinate Donald Trump, then we can just add that to this most extraordinary of election campaigns, where he survived what were very clearly two assassination attempts against him, one in Pennsylvania and one here in Florida, where a gunman was apprehended who had been very near to him on his golf course. Now, in essence, the US Justice Department is saying there was a third on the go as well.
That's Will Grant talking to me a little earlier from Florida. Well, joining me from Los Angeles is Ben Taliblu, a senior fellow at Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a research institute focusing on national security and foreign policy. And Mr. Taliblu has advised successive US administrations on Iran for the last 12 years. Welcome to the World Tonight. I wonder what you make of today's events.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you. Unfortunately, there was a pattern of behavior established both by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps towards President Trump, as well as, of course, towards this organization, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, using transnational criminal syndicates and local guns for hire to carry out their attempts to silence dissidents and activists and those who speak out about them across multiple continents now. So unfortunately, this is a intensification of a threat we've seen for several years.
Why would Donald Trump be an assassination target for the Iranians?
While one can't immediately get into the minds of the Ayatollahs and the IRGC generals giving these go orders, but nonetheless, we can piece together, indeed, we can piece together the three vectors of success that the Trump administration had against Iran that were unlike any other. From 2018 to 2020, there was what was called the maximum pressure campaign. In terms of macroeconomics, this was exceptionally damaging to the sources of revenue that the regime has traditionally generated, oil, petrochemical, and it was able to do so in record time, unlike a decade of multilateral sanctions. On top of that, Trump stood with the Iranian people, breaking sacred cows and taboos about these foreign support being the kiss of death and proving it wasn't during the multiple rounds of nationwide anti-regime protests. And then lastly, he killed Qasem Soleimani, the chief terrorist of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the regional mastermind of the terrorist apparatus that we see in the Middle East today. And these are three unforgivable things in the minds of Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei.
And do you think, considering organizing his assassination would be regarded as similarly unforgivable by the new president when he takes office?
Indeed, it would seem like that. I think during the campaign, once he tweeted something to that effect, hoping of a response in the case that the Ayatollahs were successful. But revenge is a dish best served cold. I think a successful Iran policy, one that actually bridges the transatlantic gap that existed during the latter 2 years of the Trump administration, would go a very long way of allowing Trump to have signal personal and professional success against the IRGC.
Might that tempt him to encourage Israel to take further action against Iran once he himself is in office in January?
I think there's no doubt that Israel will have a freer hand against the myriad Iranian proxies that have encircled the Jewish state for many years now, both during the transition period that we're in, as well as, of course, during the 4 years that President Trump will be in office. But as to that being used to green light major military action, which is part of the campaign that the Trump administration was elected on to do less of in the Middle East, not more, I find that at the present to be highly dubious.
In office, Trump did surprise people in foreign policy from time to time, didn't he? For example, by the summit meeting with Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, with whom relations had been frozen for the best part of a decade between the US and the North Koreans. He then negotiated with the Taliban and announced a date when American troops would pull out of Afghanistan, which Joe Biden then honoured. And is it possible that, as he has said in the past, he might consider inviting Iran to take part in the Abraham Accords to try and find a way in which Iran would recognise Israel, something, of course, it has been opposed to for almost its entire history as an Islamic republic?
Well, I think it's a near certain fact that the Islamic Republic of Iran, under the current constellation of clerics and military men who lead it, would absolutely do no such thing. And in some ways, the ultimate guarantor of a world brought to you by more conflict and Abraham Accords that excludes Iran is the fact that Iran's leaders have agency and they would never sign up for such a thing. But who might is potentially the Iranian people. Very much so, one would say, the Iranian people. And if they ever get a government that represents their views, values, and interests, then that government might be able to partake in exactly that kind of offer. But until then, it's essentially a no-go zone for the regime's leaders.
Benam Ben Taliblu of the Foundation for Democracies, thanks very much for joining us from the United States. Coming up later, no dating, no sex, no children, no marriage to men.
If you secretly had to vote for Kamala because of your husband, I just want you to know that it's okay to divorce him. We're building a whole community of ladies who are happy being single. And guess what? If your husband voted for Trump, he hates your guts.
What's the influence of the 4B movement, launched by women in South Korea and now attracting young Americans in the wake of Donald Trump's election victory? But before all that, let's look at the state of the Church of England. John Smythe, a barrister by profession, was a highly influential figure in the Church of England. He was also its most prolific known abuser, with more than 100 male victims. He died 6 years ago and has been the subject of an independent review published yesterday afternoon. The findings and the Archbishop's response to them is causing deep unease at senior levels in the church. The Macon Review found that as early as the mid-1980s, figures in the Church of England hierarchy knew Smythe was abusing young men and boys he met through church camps. He used severe beatings, and they really were severe, to punish what he called their sins. The punishments were frequently sexualised. Some of the boys were left incontinent by his abuse. Keith Macon and his team concluded that from 1984, church officials in effect became enablers of abuse because they knew it was happening and failed to stop it. After an investigation by Channel 4 in 2017 exposed Smythe, Archbishop Justin Welby, who had attended one of the camps himself as a young man in the 1970s, told Channel 4 he knew nothing about abuse allegations against the man until that report. The Macon Review, however, finds that was incorrect. Justin Welby knew Smythe was an abuser in 2013. On Channel 4 News last night, the Archbishop told presenter Cathy Newman he had considered resigning as a result of the Macon Review's findings, as some of the victims are now demanding.
I've been giving that a lot of thought for actually quite a long time. There's nothing over the last 10 years that has been as horrible as dealing with not just this one, but innumerable other abuse cases, as you will see from the ICSA inquiry and other things. I've given it a lot of thought. I've taken advice as recently as this morning from senior colleagues. And no, I'm not going to resign for this. If I'd known before 2013 or had grounds for suspicion, that would be a resigning matter then and now. But I didn't.
But you considered it as recently as this morning?
Yes.
It's not just the gap between what the Archbishop had previously told Channel 4 and what the Macon Review has found. It's that the church never reported Smythe to the police. The barrister moved to Southern Africa and continued abusing men and boys, this time in South Africa and Zimbabwe, with complete impunity, almost until he died, aged 75, in Cape Town in 2018.
John Smythe should have been properly and effectively reported to the police in the UK and to relevant authorities in South Africa. This represented a further missed opportunity to bring him to justice and may have resulted in an ongoing and avoidable safeguarding threat in the period between 2012 and his death in 2018.
Well, this afternoon, Julie Connolly, the Bishop of Birkenhead, gave her reaction to PM.
If I read Macon, he very clearly states that Justin Welby held a personal and moral responsibility to pursue things further. And so, yes, that's a failing for which the Archbishop has apologised. I think the question for me is whether words are enough.
Well, that was the view of Bishop Connolly of Birkenhead. Andrew Greystone is an advocate for the survivors of John Smythe's abuse and indeed for others abused by people in the Church of England. And he joins us now. Andrew Greystone, thanks very much for talking to us about this terrible case. And I'm aware that there are other people who have been charged with offences that are currently still the subject of police investigation. So we should leave that to one side. But Smythe is dead. We know and we can talk openly about what he was accused of doing. How would you characterise the scale of his abuse and the damage that he did both to individuals and to the ideas that the church stands for?
Well, the Macon Review published yesterday says that his abuse was prolific, brutal and horrific. And I think that's a good description. It was also a horrendous corruption of what the gospel that he claimed to be representing is all about. The idea that it takes an older man beating you naked until you bleed in order to purge you of your sins couldn't be any further from most people's understanding of the Christian gospel.
And in one case, encouraging a young man to self-harm to punish himself for his sinful thoughts or behaviour.
Indeed. And in Africa, we have to remember that one young man died in very suspicious circumstances at one of John Smythe's camps. It's been terrible, really horrendous. But if anything has been more horrendous than John Smythe's abuse, it has been the church's response to it over the last well, now 40 years.
And that's very clear from the review. In the light of that, it looks as if inaction, sins of omission as well as commission, resulted in particular in Southern Africa, in young boys and men being abused, and as you say, perhaps even worse, in a way that could have been prevented. Is that the most damning charge, do you think, against the Archbishop tonight?
Yes, we can't hold Archbishop Justin Welby responsible for what happened in the 1980s.
Indeed.
He went to the camps, as you say, not only in the late 70s, but also in the late 80s and the early 90s.
Right.
There's no doubt that senior figures in the Church of England conducted a wholesale cover-up in the early 1980s. But that's not the allegation against the Archbishop of Canterbury now. What we now know from the report is that by 2013, at least six bishops who are currently serving, including the Archbishop of Canterbury, and at least another five bishops who are now retired, and at least another 30 more junior clergy, by that time, by 2013, knew about what Smythe had been doing, but failed to stop him and allowed him to carry on potentially abusing young men until he died in 2018.
Now, there are two very specific things, aren't there? The one is that in 2017, he told Channel 4 that Smythe's abuse was news to him, but the Malcolm Review says he knew 4 years earlier, and he's acknowledged that, actually, in the interview he gave yesterday. But he hasn't explained why he told a different story to Channel 4 in 2017.
It's hard to understand, isn't it? I mean, I have the document or copy of the document in front of me with which Archbishop Welby was briefed in August 2013. And whilst it doesn't contain all the horrors that we now know about, it does give a very graphic picture of what Smythe had done back in 2013. We know that it went across Archbishop Welby's desk. There's a note from his chaplain saying, "You probably knew this man." The big question there is, why did Archbishop Welby not say to himself, "Gosh, this awful horror is describing a man that I knew, a man that I exchanged Christmas cards with,
and a man he'd clearly respected in the past."
Yeah, that he'd supported financially whilst he was in Africa.
Can I just
ask, why did that not ring a bell then?
Can I ask just one last question, if I may? The Archbishop of Canterbury sits in the House of Lords, therefore he helps make the country's laws, yet he didn't refer Smythe's case to the police or inform the police. What is the mood you're picking up among the people you've talked to in the church? Do they think his position is tenable?
Certainly, a number of the Smythe victims who I've spoken to today want him to go, and so do some very senior figures in the church. I'm not sure what that would achieve. He only has a few months left before his compulsory retirement. We have to remember that Justin Welby is himself a victim of bullying, not least within the House of Bishops, which is a horribly toxic group. And if he leaves now, he'll leave the culture of the church unchanged and the church no safer. What needs to happen now is a wholesale exporting of the church's responsibility for safeguarding. It needs to have an independent body, perhaps the equivalent of the Independent Office for Police Conduct, so that those people who find themselves in the awful position of having been abused by clergy don't then have to go to yet more senior clergy to ask them to sort it out.
Andrew,
we need wholesale independence, as has been recommended to the church. But sadly, senior figures in the church are very resistant to that still.
Andrew Greystone, thank you very much. Now, let us talk about something a little happier, if a little mysterious. A creature an awful long way from home who's feeling rather lonely.
Thousands of emperors are coming to this frozen bay. They are here because the new ice provides the safest place for them to breed.
That was David Attenborough, Sir David Attenborough, in his series Dynasties, talking about emperor penguins in 2018. They're native to Antarctica. So why on earth did Gus, as his rescuer now calls him, pitch up on the southern coast of Western Australia? It's thought this is the most northerly sighting of an emperor penguin ever reported. Gus was so malnourished, his bones were sticking out. But wildlife carer Carol Bidoff is attempting to nurse him back to health.
The bird sort of turned at an angle and I could see its backbone protruding, and I thought, this bird is well undernourished. So that was a real consideration for bringing it in. I've never had to deal with a large penguin like this before. They've always been a lot smaller, our local little penguins. Never in my wildest thoughts would I thought I'd ever have an emperor penguin to care for. It's just such a privilege to be part of this bird's journey.
Well, good luck to her and to Gus. Let's go live now to the British Antarctic Survey in Cambridge. Dr. Peter Fretwell has discovered nearly half of the known emperor penguin breeding grounds using satellite imagery. He's also made several visits to one of the species colonies in the Antarctic. What do you make of the case of Gus, Peter?
Well, it's certainly unusual and possibly unique. Occasionally, emperor penguins do go well north of Antarctica, and we find them in and around the Southern Ocean on some of the subantarctic islands. But I don't think we've recorded one ever as far north as southern Australia.
How far off course was he?
Probably about 2,000 miles, which is quite a long way. Why he's turned up there is a bit of a mystery. We honestly don't know whether he's got disorientated or he's been sick or he's just followed the wrong path. It's hard to tell.
Well, hopefully, with the good efforts of Carol Bidoff, he will get back to full health and be able to get back where he should be. But the question at the moment appears to me, not only is he on his own, but emperor penguins are increasingly finding it difficult to breed. What's going on?
Yeah, down in the breeding grounds around the coast of Antarctica, they're up against a battle with climate change. The waters around Antarctica are warming up, and the sea ice for the last few years has been decreasing year on year almost. So that means that the fast ice, the platform on which they breed, which is frozen seawater, is often breaking up before their chicks actually can fledge and get their waterproof feathers.
How much under pressure are numbers of emperor penguins, do you think? I mean, I gather you've been to a colony in the Antarctic several times. I mean, what should it be like and what is it like now?
Well, it's not disastrous yet. This is going to be something which gets worse and worse over the next few years. So you wouldn't really notice if you went to a colony today. You may see a few less, but the problem is that this is happening again and again. And some of the colonies are taking a real battering and haven't bred successfully for 2 or 3 years. And probably because emperor penguins only have one chick per year, every year that they lose is important.
What's their sort of average lifespan? Because presumably they only have a certain number of years in which they will be breeding anyway.
Yeah, they live for about 20 years. They at maximum breed for 15 of those, although don't usually turn up every year. But there is quite high mortality amongst the chicks and juveniles. So even though they can have 15 chicks between two adults, they won't. Not all of those will ever reach adulthood and breed themselves.
If the planet keeps warming at its current rate, how much longer before the emperor penguin is in real danger of extinction?
Well, the models that we have at the moment suggest that by the end of the century, about 70, 75 years, that they'll virtually be extinct. But having said that, we're not sure if those models are correct, whether they're overestimates or underestimates. And one of our real projects at the British Antarctic Survey is to try and see what the population actually is doing, using satellite imagery to monitor those populations and see if we can track that decline and see what chances they have.
And let's hope Gus gets back to full health, gets back to where he belongs and gets to mate. Peter Fretwell, thank you very much for joining us from the British Antarctic Survey. You're listening to The World Tonight. The main headline so far, US prosecutors have filed charges against three men they say were part of an Iranian plot to assassinate President-elect Donald Trump. Pressure's growing on the Archbishop of Canterbury after a report found the Church of England covered up abuse by a barrister. The Metropolitan Police Force is to be investigated over its handling of sexual assault complaints against the former Harrods owner, the late Mohammed Al-Fayed. And Queen Camilla says June Spencer, Peggy in the Archers and the last surviving member of the original cast of the programme in 1951, who's died today aged 105, will be greatly missed. In all, June's radio acting career lasted for 85 years. Here she is recalling how her art, sadly, came to imitate her life.
There have been two big stories for me in the Archers. One was Jack and Peggy's wedding, and the other was, of course, Jack's Alzheimer's. And you, so handsome in your morning suit. Here we are again. Do you remember my bouquet, Jack? Christmas roses, freesias, and the little winter berries. This, of course, was a reflection in what had happened to me in real life, because Roger, towards the end of our long and happy marriage, began to show signs of Alzheimer's, and it got steadily worse. Then he had a stroke, and eventually, of course, he died. But I have one wonderful memory. Just, I think it was 2 days before that happened. It was a beautiful day in May. The flowers were lovely in the garden. And I said, let's have lunch in the garden today. So I helped him out and sat him under the sun umbrella. And I made a nice salad. We had a bottle of chilled white wine. And he kept saying, what a lovely lunch. Isn't this lovely? And that was a wonderful memory to have.
June Spencer, Peggy Willie Nay Archer, as she was for so many years here on Radio 4, remembering her own late husband. June Spencer died today at the age of 105. Demonstrations have been banned for 3 days in the Dutch capital Amsterdam after hit-and-run attacks on visiting Israeli football fans last night. Maccabi Tel Aviv were in the city for an away match against Ajax Amsterdam in the Europa League. Young men clad in black roamed the streets on foot and on scooters, attacking Maccabi supporters. Five of them were hospitalised and more than 60 people, so far unidentified, have been arrested. This Maccabi fan said the police had arrived too late.
There was a lot of people. They saw everyone in yellow. They jumped on us. They stabbed people. They beat them.
Femke Halsema, Amsterdam's mayor, said the attacks brought to her mind anti-Jewish pogroms in the Netherlands past.
In Amsterdam, there are many demonstrations and protests, and we are always prepared for them. And, of course, they are related to the situation in the Middle East and the ongoing war in Israel and Palestine. But what happened last night is not a protest. It has nothing to do with protest or demonstration. It was crime.
Amsterdam's chief of police, Peter Holler, said Israeli supporters had attacked a taxi and set fire to a Palestinian flag. Maccabi fans were also filmed chanting expletive-laden slogans against Arabs and shouting, "Let the IDF win," a reference to the Israeli army's action in Gaza and Lebanon. Well, Eran Zahavi plays for Maccabi Tel Aviv. After returning to Israel today, he described the incident to journalists, saying the club would be helping returning fans.
We all saw what happened. It was a disgrace. But this is the world we're living in right now. And unfortunately, our crowd felt very threatened and there were horrors taking place. And that's a shame. They came to watch football, but that's what happened. We will support them in any way possible and the club will do everything to guarantee the fans' safe return.
Well, after the violence, Israel's Foreign Minister Gideon Saar flew into the Netherlands with a message for the Dutch government.
Those attacks was maybe one of the biggest attacks against Jews on the soil of Europe since the 40s. So I think that it is extremely important that the Netherlands will do its utmost in order to bring to trial those who were involved in these barbaric attacks against Jews and Israelis in Amsterdam.
The response of the Dutch government came from the Justice Minister, David van Wiel, who said those responsible for the attacks would be brought to justice.
I apologise to the minister for the shameful attacks that happened last night in Amsterdam. As the minister says, this is not what Amsterdam stands for and this should not happen again. So our priority has been to restore order and then we need to go after the people that perpetrated this and we will prosecute them.
Well, the first of six evacuation flights bringing Maccabi supporters home from Amsterdam are due to arrive in Israel shortly. Now, some American women on social media platforms like TikTok and Instagram have, since the election of Donald Trump earlier this week, started showing an increased interest in a social trend originating in South Korea. Called the 4B movement, its proponents swear off dating men, having sex with men, marrying men, and having children with them.
A quick rundown on what you need to do when wanting to participate in the 4B movement and you don't know where to start. We're going to move on to the dating apps. Delete all profiles. Don't just delete the app, delete the profiles and then delete the app. Stop talking to the men. Delete, block, say your goodbyes and leave it at that.
If you secretly had to vote for Kamala because of your husband, I just want you to know that it's okay to divorce him. We're building a whole community of ladies who are happy being single. And guess what? If your husband voted for Trump, especially if he knows that you didn't, he hates your guts. Come join us over here on this side. It's called the right side of history.
Just an example of posts shared in the past few days on TikTok. I've been finding out more about the origins of the 4B movement from Minju Lee. She's an assistant professor at Occidental College in Los Angeles, where she studies the intersection of Asian studies, gender studies and media.
4B, to explain the term a little bit first, in Korean is pronounced as 비혼, 비연애, 비출산, and 비섹. In English, literal translation of it is no marriage, no relationship, no birth, and no sex. And it refers to a movement where some group of women, feminists, decided that they are fed up with the patriarchal system and the misogyny that was latent in Korean society for a long time, and that they are going to do something about it. The 4B movement became more of a mainstream thing starting in 2019, when there was this onslaught of mainstream news that was reporting about digital sexual violence cases that occurred in Korea. Notably, in 2019, for instance, in Korea, there was this notorious incident called the Anthurium incident, where allegedly a few thousand men participated in a Discord chat room where they were exchanging illicit sexual images and videos of women that were not consensually taken or provided. So after realizing that this was something that so many men participated in, a lot more women decided that they were going to participate in the 4B movement because they felt like they couldn't trust any of the men in their lives. And until they could trust the people, they are going to refrain from interaction with men.
How widespread has it become in South Korea?
It's not mainstream in the sense that a lot of women, majority of women, are participating in it. Of course, some women are not engaging in marriage or birth for another reason, more economic. But then for the people who are specifically engaging in 4B movement for a feminist cause, it isn't actually a whole large number. So I would say it's still a minority.
It's had quite an impact, though, on social media, hasn't it? And now has translated to the United States. What's happening in America? Why is it being picked up there?
So in the U.S., after the election, this current election results came out, some women, especially it seems like the women who are living in more red states, decided that actually they, similar to the Korean woman who felt like they couldn't trust the men in their lives, also couldn't trust the men who are in their lives or potentially the men who they might go out on dates with. So they decided that they were also going to refrain from the sexual relationships or dating with men until they can know actually that these men are men who can be trusted to honor, respect women and respect women's health.
Do they think then that white, black, Latino men who have voted for Donald Trump somehow become suspect to them, that they are not trustworthy? Is that the kind of wider thought that means this movement is not just about him, but it's about people who see him as a role model?
Yes, because in some sense, it seems like the sexual misconduct allegations, as well as how big of an issue women's health and abortion rights was for this election, it seems the case that even if all the men who voted for Donald Trump are not opposed to abortion rights or opposed to women's rights or other things, that it seems to be the case that that is something that they are willing to kind of sideline in order to vote him into the office. So that is a factor.
Back in South Korea, what impact has 4B made? Has it got men to rethink about their behaviour, to change their behaviour towards South Korean women?
That's an interesting question, because there has been some change, but not necessarily in a good way. And that is one of the things that I'm partly concerned about for the 4B movement in the US as well, because in Korea, this movement has been happening for quite a while. And the results that you see nowadays isn't necessarily like a lot of men saying that, oh, they're feminist now or that they believe in women's cause. It's more so the case that some men have become very radical anti-feminist as a reaction to the 4B movement. So it doesn't seem to be the case that on an individual level, it has changed men's perspective to be more like gender equal or feminist. It has gone in the other direction.
So greater polarization.
Greater polarization, yes.
Do you worry that could happen in the United States too?
I do worry about that and think that is a pretty big possibility in the U.S. as well, because if there aren't any specific demands for legal reform or certain demands that the 4B movement are making, then it's kind of unclear to the men or the larger society that they're trying to send a message to what needs to be done in order for this movement to stop eventually.
That's Professor Minju Lee in California on the 4B movement. Our closing headline tonight, the US government has charged an Iranian man in connection with an alleged plot to assassinate Donald Trump. Prosecutors say 51-year-old Fahad Shakiri has not been arrested. He's believed to be in Iran. The Justice Department has arrested and charged two other men in New York who it claims had been recruited to kill an American journalist who was an outspoken critic of Iran. And let me end on something rather different for you tonight. It's the news about Beyoncé and her achievement in the award ceremony taking place. It's news that she's making history once again.
This ain't Texas. Ooh. Ain't no hold'em. Hey. So lay your cards down.
Just become the most nominated artist of all time at the Grammys, overtaking her husband Jay-Z. The couple had been tied on 88 nominations each, but Beyoncé has now pulled ahead thanks to recognition for her new album, Cowboy Carter. She leads this year's Grammys race with 11 nominations, including Best Album, Best Country Album, and Song of the Year for this, Texas Hold'em. That's the world tonight. Good night.
A breakup, kisses, sweet redemption, passing time, yeah. Ooh, one step too.